33511 user experience. For this podcast snack, we're going to look at the principles of efficient experience, and this typically means usability principles, but I think it means more than that. I'm trying to differentiate it from the traditional idea of usability, which is really about task completion time and things that are quantifiable, and try and think a bit more broadly. So for instance, examples of good usability are there on the front page. We've got the Nest thermostat, which doesn't rely on you really understanding how to use the actual system per se. It's very familiar how this should be done. I think that in relation to something like the modern thermostat that comes from the sort of Honeywell and the kind of more old heating company standard, then it's much more impenetrable because it looks like it's giving you lots of information, but how you get to that information and change that information really requires on you remembering. And if you only use these thermostats occasionally, then remembering is a problem, right? Because you have to relearn it every time. So learnability is a particularly important part. Now, when we think about usability in the wider sense, this was really created in the very early days of HCI and really of software engineering with the STAR user interface. The STAR user interface really wanted to push forward what's called skeuomorphic design. It wasn't called that, of course, then back then, but the idea was that the computer would be more familiar to people if it took the names, the ideas behind standard everyday items that we're familiar using and recharacterize those in the context of computational interfaces. And so that's why we still have a desktop, because that's one of the concepts that they decided was useful. A trash bin. Files and folders. Okay, previously these were called directories, but actually we call them files and folders because they were trying to be likened to things that people understood, which was filing cabinets. There was plenty of innovative universal usability work that came from the STAR, Xerox STAR, things around universality of commands, that the same command would do the same thing for every application on the platform. That was very novel. Beforehand, you know, it was up to the developer to decide what key combination did what. And you can see that's the case, that you don't have something consistent between, say, for instance, Emacs, Vim, Vi. Well, probably Vim and Vi you do. But that kind of consistency wasn't really there. And the STAR Xerox interface really brought that forward. Consistency, simplicity were also things that they prioritized, and user tailorability, so therefore you could change aspects of the interface to suit you. One thing they also did was called dog fooding, which meant that they would, before they distributed this interface, they created a whole number of machines, and these machines were placed in the Xerox PARC laboratory where the STAR interface was created, and they were used for a year, and they were tested for a year, and that was really important, specifically for making sure that everything worked and did what it was meant to do. And so this was another innovation that had not been actually thought about before. Now, universal design and design for all are concepts that also came out of these kind of early days, but were only formulated and formalized more as the decades went on, in around the 80s, etc. And this really is this universal design, specifically the design for all, was kind of put forward more by Greg van der Heijden, which tries to link usability to accessibility. Because what it says is that, yes, things have got to be usable, but they've got to be usable for everybody, that everybody, no matter what their requirements are, both physically, cognitively, perceptually, has got to be accommodated in Now, this is really important because that wasn't even thought of previously. Previously, the idea that we were going to have this universal design where everybody would be taken into account, it was really more, first of all, we thought, well, in terms of specialist users. Then we thought more in terms with, in the kind of terms of usability for people who had standard requirements, if you like. They could use a keyboard, they could use a video screen. Now we think in terms of everybody, however that context of use is going to be, and the kinds of people that are going to use it, and in what situations those people are going to use that work. Out of this work came things called usability models, where we were trying to understand how to make the systems as usable, but efficiently usable as possible. And that meant that we wanted to be able to quantify how long certain tasks would take. So we decided we're going to be able to do this by thinking about how things work biological world, in the physiological world, in the cognitive world, and we're going to be able to capture that and add in some delay for the computer, and then, hey presto, we will see how we can model how long each task will take, because this is the point when task time, measuring these things, were super important as part of the traditional aspects of HCI. And so we have things like the human processor model, which didn't work. We have things like the goals, operators, methods and selection rules model, which again kind of worked but not really. And then we came down to the KLM model, the keystroke level model, which sort of worked. The difference here is that certainly the human processor model tried to do everything and was very complicated. The GOMES model tried to put things into more quantifiable groups. It still didn't work that well. And the KLM model was just really about leveling sort of keystrokes, measuring keystrokes. Okay. And therefore, because it was quite simple, it sort of worked. Now, out of all of the usability literature, and there is a lot of usability literature, there are commonalities, certainly within the concepts, if not the way that they're described, or at least if not the terms that are used through this work. So what I've done section 11.4, collated usability principles, guidelines and rules, is I've looked at all the literature with regard to usability. I've put that literature together, looked for the common principles and clustered those common principles. Okay, and you can see that in table collated usability principles. So I've then thrown out some usability principles that I think actually are better in accessibility, or they're better in some of the next principles that we're going to come up on in chapters 12 and 13. And I've put the rest together as these potted principles. And these potted principles are principles that are supposed to be descriptive, and they're supposed to take into account the number of people, the literature, that says that these concepts are more about usability and they're less specialist. So we have facilitate familiarity. I think that comes from the Xerox Star interface. Interaction stability, so that we're doing the same interactions all the time. Facilitate learnability. Okay, so we want to be able to learn something and then not have to keep relearning it every time we go to the back to the system, even if the interval between us going back to the system is long. We want to facilitate robustness, so things work as we expect them to do. So I've taken that from the accessibility principles and placed it in usability, because it needs to be here for things not falling over. Facilitate progressive disclosure, so this means that we don't want to see everything in one long list. We want to move point by point down a cognitive trail, if you like, so that we can uncover things by progressive disclosure. So for instance, we might want to do file, open, and then open the file, we don't just have open as being the first part of the menu. So these are things, this is where we classify sub-items into sub-items into sub-items. This is what progressive disclosure means. Facilitate scalability. So are we able to scale what we're doing? How does this look if you've got large, for instance, large data sets? What about if there's lots of large interactions? How do we work with those? We need to also facilitate simplicity. And one of the interesting things is situational awareness, whereby we can understand where we are in an interaction just by the awareness of the selections we've made. So something on the screen changes such that we understand where we are based on that situational awareness. You can see that I've created an example here from the Amazon co.uk checkout. You can see that here we know where we are because we're at the welcome screen, and we also know where we've got to go. We know implicitly how many steps there is. We know, based on what's written, what information will be needed. We also know that this is progressive disclosure because it's not giving us one screen with all of these sections on it in one go. And so therefore we can see that this kind of situational awareness, but progressive disclosure, is also super useful and is used actually quite a lot, pretty much everywhere. Okay, so in summary then, for usability, I think what we really want to think about is what we mean by usability in the wider context, that usability has to be thought of not just in terms of task completion time and the speed at which we can get things done, but also in the quality of what actually comes out of those things that are done. And we can also understand that there are a number of principles that will help facilitate usability, which maybe software engineers and developers don't already know, at least explicitly, and so therefore from a UX perspective you need to elaborate these to developers and to software engineers to make sure they fully understand what it is we're actually going for. Okay, what is best design practice for UX when it comes to usability? And that's some knowledge that you have but they might not have. Okay. And on that, we're going to finish this one here, and we'll move on to the principles of effective experience in the next podcast snack.